Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, a show featuring the people, stories, and events of Central Iowa. I'm your host today, together with Greta Anderson. That's my name.
That's you.
Together with Gail Seiler.
That's me.
Hi, Gail. Yeah. Good to be back in the studio with you.
Yeah, we haven't co-hosted in quite a while, so it's fun.
And I understand today is going to be a hot one.
It is, and you know me, I don't like hot weather, so I'm ready for fall and coolness.
The show today is right along your interests, being an education professor in the School of Ed at Iowa State. We're going to cover all kinds of education issues.
Yes.
And in the studio with us is someone who's becoming a regular guest here on Local Talk. We're very excited about that, Kathy Hansen, Director of School and Media Relations. Welcome, Kathy.
Thank you. Good to be here again.
And you've brought with you Melissa Askloff, an AmeriCorps Vista member. Hello, Melissa.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
And you are working with Jean Cressy over at United Way.
Yes, that's right.
Okay. And so we're talking today, Kathy, about attendance awareness, but more than that, it sounds like.
Well, yes, because we launch our focus on attendance awareness in September. It is National Attendance Awareness Month, and we partner with so many organizations because this topic is so important to students and their ability to learn as much as they can during the school year.
Attendance awareness, okay, you got to go to school. You get in trouble if you don't. What else do I need to know?
Well, chronic absenteeism is defined as missing 10% or more of the days of the school year. And so many statistics have shown that at different milestones, students start falling behind, even if preschool and kindergarten red flags go up. If they become chronically absent, they're less likely to reach that all-important milestone of reading at grade-level proficiency by third grade. By the time they're in sixth grade, they're at risk of dropping out of high school. So that's just the statistical data that we use to know when we need to intervene and what the consequences of not intervening are.
I mean, just to jump in here, 10% absenteeism, really just, I would flip that around if I were a student and say, hey, I'm attending school 90% of the time. That's pretty good. I'm only missing one day out of 2 weeks. But even one day out of a two-week school period, that can affect kids' performance.
Exactly. Well, I think we've talked a little bit before, since I've been coming regularly, about how education has changed. And the learning cycle, it's a sequence of building on concepts. It's called gradual release of responsibility. So that if it's not just the teacher standing and telling you what to do, but it's all these other steps where you learn in groups, you learn individually, and finally, you're able to not just tell the teacher what you know, but you're able to apply that knowledge in innovative ways. So if you miss and can't build in that sequence, it's really, really hard to make that up. You can't really make up not being there and being part of that process.
Right. So it's an experience you're missing. It's not one section of the textbook that you go back and
exactly
read. That's very different from how it was when I was in school, for sure. And you were going to say something else about the broader picture.
Well, I would like Melissa to talk a little bit about the partners who help us with raising awareness about the issue and the resources they also provide.
Yes. So we partner with Youth and Shelter Service, and they have wonderful mentoring services. And it's shown how important having a mentor to some students really can be, just having that one person to make a difference so that you want to come to school every day. Also, Raising Readers.
That's a great organization. I know Jean Cressy's been very involved in that in the United Way. Raising Readers has been very involved in these summer programs that help make sure that summer slide doesn't happen and students don't lose what they've learned over the school year.
And also, Melissa and her predecessors have been really good at helping our building principals find really innovative and engaging ways to implement our attendance policy. So our policy says that we need to be communicating with parents before absences become chronic. But how we do that and how we motivate them is where it gets innovative. And they've been able to provide a lot of resources and coaching and even mentoring for the principals and giving them ideas. Why don't you tell a little bit about what Mr. Jeffs is doing at Mitchell?
Oh, sure. So Mr. Jeffs, he has a lot of great activities. One of them includes, like, starting October 1st, he'll have a big contest school-wide, and all of the classrooms are going to compete. And so the goal is that your class has the highest attendance rate, and then you'll get a trophy for the next month to celebrate that your class had this high attendance. And then
And then they pass the trophy along to the next month's winner. Is that the concept?
Yeah, yeah. And okay. So it continues.
Oh, that's neat.
And so behind the scenes, we have school and family counselors and teachers and the principal working with the families to identify what might be the barrier to getting to school. And you might have things all the way from the families in transition and struggling in some way, and it's just hard to keep a routine, to a family that just wants to take a vacation. And so we have to work with those families to help them understand, well, here's what we can do to help you with this transitional situation in your life versus, well, it's nice that you can take this vacation, but we really don't skip school for vacations in Ames. You know, getting that culture established. So it's a wide range of things that we have to do, but Mr. Jeffs just makes it fun and motivating.
Right, and the students, of course, don't want to let their peers down. That would be not a good thing.
I would think that the reasons that students don't come to school might be somewhat different for elementary than for older students. I mean, once students get into middle school and high school, they have a lot more autonomy and maybe deciding on their own not to come to school, not because of, you know, the family didn't drop them off or something. So how do you explore that? How do you learn about that? Like, what are the reasons why older students don't come to school?
Well, you really have to know the students, and I think one thing we can say in our secondary schools and middle school and high school is the culture is very much of interconnectedness. So you've got a team approach at the middle school where the students move around their classes in a team where the teachers know each other and the students know each other. In the high school, Mr. Evans has a philosophy that he wants every single student to be connected to another adult staff member who knows that student beyond, well, that student's in my homeroom, so I have to know them. So it's a relationship. So there's a real culture of, I know this student, and so I'm going to pick up on what's going on in the student's life, and I'm going to have a way of differentiating how I respond to that situation and not just a blanket approach. So it's developmentally appropriate. There's a really good program that we do in elementary school called Responsive Classroom, which is helping students with social emotional learning and community building. And then middle school, that is a different program that builds on that developmentally called Developmental Designs. By the time they get in high school, they have that framework in place, and then they realize the students have more autonomy, but they still really try to stay connected with them.
And I know the dropout rate at Ames High School has been going down. Is that something that you monitor as well, and is that connected with attendance?
Yes, because as we were saying, there's a real strong correlation between attendance at the sixth grade level and dropping out of high school later. So we're trying, even at the preschool level, our Northwood Preschool Center principal, Brandon Shrouth, is instilling this awareness in families even at preschool. So we're starting at the very, very beginning because we want students to be able to reach these milestones in a way that addresses the whole student, the family, the social emotional learning, what they should be learning developmentally and academically at each touchstone.
Well, you know, school can be such a petri dish for for disease. And how do you deal with the whole problem of illness? And
well, that's a real good question, Greta. We don't want students coming to school sick.
Right.
So we really do try to communicate with parents and relieve their anxieties so that they know we've got guidelines for how long to keep your child home after they've had a fever or something is coming out of them that we don't want to be coming out of school. So the nurses and the teachers and the principals work with parents to understand those things. So we don't want students coming into school sick just so they can get an attendance trophy. And we also do a lot of healthy behaviors during school, washing hands, teaching people how to cover their coughs, And the adults, we are having our flu shot clinics coming up pretty soon in the district, so we try to take care of ourselves as well.
Sounds like such a proactive kind of approach to attendance. Even the name, attendance awareness, is sort of a proactive kind of approach. So different from, you know, the old days where it's about truancy and punishment.
Boy, that's a good point. That's a good point. I'm so glad I live now and I got to see how we're changing our perspective to be proactive.
Yeah, and we really don't want this to be a blame the school district, blame parents, blame anyone. It's really a community effort. As they say, it takes a village.
Right, and even the whole approach to hand washing, you know, so many pieces of a puzzle go to making a healthy student, making a healthy community. And if the students are motivated to come to school, they don't want to get sick, they learn that washing their hands is a good way to prevent getting sick. So it really just all fits together so well.
I just don't want the time to get away from us before I acknowledge what a partnership this is with the community. And was it last week at City Council, the mayor issued a proclamation that September is Attendance Awareness Month. And it's so inspiring to see the City Council up there, all the community partners, and the people who come to be involved in city government just affirming their partnership with us to be out in the community and supporting all the things that go along with what the school district does that complement what we do and really reinforce that culture.
Yeah. United Way is, and it's got a huge job in the fall, you know, to start gearing up for the United Way fund drive. And there's so many different directions United Way could go, but it has chosen to really get on board so many of these education issues in partnership with the Ames School District.
If you follow social media, we try to get clever with our hashtags. And this year we've used several. We've used Everyday Counts, Attendance Matters, and just for Ames, we've used Bring Your A Game. So if you follow any social media, you can look for those hashtags and see some of the things we've posted.
Oh, okay. Hashtag. Okay. So can you repeat those again? I got sort of hung up on hashtags, but you know, I know what hashtags are. But.
Okay. Everyday Counts.
Everyday Counts.
Attendance Matters.
Attendance Matters.
Bring Your A Game.
Bring Your A Game.
Last year we had Aim to Be in School. You know, try to get, you know, try to get clever. But.
And so you're on Twitter and you are.
We're on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram.
Oh, Instagram. Yeah. Do you have to get students' permissions, though, to get their photos on?
Oh, yeah. We have, we don't publish anything on social media involving a student unless they have media permission. But I take pictures of other things and do little.
Okay. And you get to explore all of the schools in mm-hmm. the district. And you too, Melissa, are you involved in all of the schools?
Yeah, I've reached out to every principal in Story County to offer my services any way that I can help them.
And have other school districts outside of Ames kind of gotten on board with this attendance awareness agenda?
Well, if you're aware of Attendance Works, it's a website created by Hetty Chang, and she also partners with Grade Level Reading Campaign, and they have created posters. And so it's Everyday Counts, and they even have ones that say Iowa makes Everyday Count, and nearly every school has allowed me to hang up those posters in their school.
That's a statewide campaign or national?
I would say that's on a national level.
That's what I was thinking. Yeah.
Last night on one of the news channels, I heard that the Des Moines metro area, the leadership in that school district is really exploring getting involved at a new level for attendance awareness, too.
Uh-huh. It's a movement. It's a national mm-hmm. movement. Well, this is great news for the residents of Ames. And is there anything else you'd like to add?
We just are so happy to be able to come and talk to your listeners every month.
Oh, thank you, Kathy. Kathy Hansen, the Ames Community School District Director of School Community and Media Relations.
Thank you, Greta.
And also Melissa Askloff, an AmeriCorps Vista member. Where are you from? Melissa.
I'm basically from Ames.
Okay.
It all worked out. Yeah, thank you.
She turned out real good.
Yeah, okay. Well, thank you for coming, and we'll see you again next month.
Okay.
Our next segment continues the education theme. Kay Puddock, our community service appreciation person, picks an organization every month to highlight, and this month it is IRIS, Iowa Resources for International Students, and she has interviewed Del Christensen, the executive director, about this wonderful program whose main activity is to conduct high school student exchanges. And I must say that I was the beneficiary of this program last year when I hosted Egyptian student Nadia Hassan. And she actually was the engineer for Local Talk for many months. And so you would maybe, if you're a regular listener, recognize that name, Nadia Abdelazim. So anyway, let's listen to Kay Puttock interviewing Del Christensen, Executive Director of IRIS, Iowa Resources for International Students. You're listening to Local Talk on KHOY.
We have both adult and youth programs. Mm-hmm. Right now, a lot of our work is on our youth programs, high school exchange. That particular program is called the Youth Exchange and Study, or YES program, and it's sponsored by the U.S. State Department. They began this program about 13 years ago now to bring over students from countries with prominent Muslim populations. It's an interesting high school exchange program because it's a lot of countries that have never had an exchange program before. We know in Western Europe that there's been exchange programs going on for 50 or more years, and that now we're seeing sons and daughters of former high school exchange students that are now high school exchange students. But this is the first time in many of these countries, especially in sub-Saharan Africa, where IRIS does a lot of its work, that they have this opportunity to come over on a high school exchange experience. The hope from the U.S. State Department is that by exposing the youth to Western culture and seeing, you know, the wonderful people that we have here in the U.S. and my preference of people in Iowa, we take Iowa Nice very seriously here, that they get a different perspective than what they might be hearing from others.
Right. And are there special experiences that they have when they're here?
There are. In addition to the typical high school exchange experience where they're attending school, we also organize cultural events for them during the year. But more importantly, we also require them to do community service and learn about volunteerism. It's a concept that's not widely accepted in all countries around the world. And we've been doing this program for 13 years now in sub-Saharan Africa, in Nigeria and Tanzania. And we've found that those alumni have gone back and not only continued their volunteer spirit when they got back to their home countries, but they engaged other youth in those countries to get involved in community service and has had some amazing results there.
So you do maintain contact with your alumni?
Yes, we do. We work with them after they've gone back to their home countries. We have our alumni are now helping with some of the orientation training for our new high school students that are coming over each year.
Okay, and when they get here, they can presumably all speak English and so
yes,
on. And they are scholarship-winning students.
Exactly. It's a merit-based program. So IRIS does the selection for YES students in Nigeria and Tanzania. In Nigeria next year, there will only be 18 students that will be selected out of an initial group of between 600 and 800. And in Tanzania, about the same amount of students, but only 16 will be selected to come over to the U.S.
Now, we were talking about concentrating on countries with a large Muslim population. But in fact, there are a lot of people in, for example, Tanzania and Nigeria that are not Muslim.
Right.
So you don't pre-select.
No. And it's interesting because throughout the merit-based process and through the recruitment process, we've been able to, over the years, and we've had about 600 students that have come from those two countries to the U.S. over the last 13 years. And it's almost exactly 50% Christian, 50% Muslim that come out of it. And interestingly enough, about 50% female and 50% male as well.
And so it just works out,
Yeah.
And presumably they get to know one another when they're here, too.
They do.
If they didn't before.
They do. They, the program is set up so they each live in a different community, but they work together in groups while they're here as well as when they get back home and become part of our alumni network.
So could you talk a bit about what kind of things they get up to when they get back?
Yeah. Our group, when they do return home, they will often be involved in community activities initially that are surrounded around either environmental cleanup activities or public safety or public health programs. But it can run the range. We've had students that have helped to drill wells for water supplies. We have had students that have helped to do community health education programs on hepatitis or malaria issues in those countries. We have had students that have been involved in helping to establish schools and doing tutoring for young people in their communities.
Okay, I'm still trying to figure out how, when they get back to their communities, how say, one female... I used to live in Tanzania.
Oh, okay. So wonderful.
How, say, a lone young female is going to get people to listen to her and to dig a well, for example.
It hasn't been easy, but oftentimes we have adult associates that we work with in Tanzania and Nigeria. And you're absolutely right. Oftentimes the youth will have a great idea that they want to do in their community when they get back, and they will talk to one of the elders in the community. And they will get an immediate response of, you're too young to be making these kinds of decisions. But the nice part is the students don't give up very easily. And so they will work with our adult associates when need be. But in some cases, they've been able to just, through their persistence, convince the elders that they're there to help, and that the helping that they provide through volunteerism in the community makes the elders look good, too.
Right, right. Yeah, some of the young women I taught in Tanzania, they would say things in their essays like, this is where they put it, everyone loves me in my village because I'm educated. So there was that side of it, too, that they would listen because, you know, these people were educated, and, or they'd been to America or whatever the case was.
Yes, there's a certain amount of, I guess the American vernacular for it would be they gain some street cred while they're when they get back.
Okay, and you do provide, there are people, like your people, on the ground there to help them out, too.
Yes, yes. Those are also volunteers that work with us in those countries.
You know, and some of them will be alumni of yours, I presume.
Yes. And now we have, alumni that started in the program as high school students 13 years ago that are involved in business and other careers.
Right, and often in developing countries, they very quickly get to very high positions.
Yes,
so,
yes.
Yeah. Influential, yes.
In addition to the volunteers in the other countries, our volunteers, especially our host family volunteers here in America, have a huge impact on that cultural experience.
Mm-hmm. Are there any particularly striking stories that you could share?
One of the stories that struck me, we had a high school exchange student, a Maasai girl from Tanzania, who was an exchange student in Atlantic, Iowa, several years ago. And while she was in Atlantic, she saw a library bookmobile. And she thought, what a wonderful idea. We should try and do something like a bookmobile back in Tanzania so that young people would have access to these books, even if they couldn't go to a library. And she got back to Tanzania and quickly realized that she probably is not going to get somebody to fund a big vehicle to fill it up with books and get it to the places where she'd like to go. And she's in the Maasai area, so the villages are quite some distance away. So she came up with the idea of a book basket library. And she installed a basket onto her bicycle. She would fill it up with books, and then she would bicycle to one of the schools or community areas, and she would deliver those books, and then she'd pick up books from there that they had read and go to the next village. And she just created her own bookmobile on her bicycle.
On her bicycle. It's
and
wonderful.
That's just a simple concept she learned in America that is impacting literacy.
Applied locally in her own way. It's wonderful. Okay, and I'm sure there's lots of stories like that.
Yeah.
I'm gonna make it.
You're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm one of your hosts, Greta Anderson, together with Gail Seiler. We're talking about issues of education and diversity. That was some music from Tanzania. They were singing in Swahili. And before that, we heard Kay Puttock discussing with Del Christensen, the executive director of IRIS, in particular their program in Tanzania and Nigeria, and ambitious young lady who decided to create a library on her bicycle, a mobile library on her bicycle, after having visited the States. Once again, I just want to actually step out of my role as host and plug this wonderful organization, IRIS. My experience with my Egyptian student, Nadia Abdelazim, last year was so exceptional. And it's kind of interesting to hear the perspective of Dell speaking about what they do when they get back. You know, I experienced Nadia's incredibly busy schedule as she involved herself in absolutely every after-school activity she could and every volunteer activity she could, just soaking up all of the opportunities that are here in the United States. I heard her and her cohort, another exchange student, talking about how they really don't have many after-school activities. In countries as diverse as France and Egypt, it's very much more of a rote learning experience where they have to prepare for an exam at the end of their school career. And so they don't have time for any of that fun stuff that actually where a lot of social learning takes place. Nadia was had so much social intelligence and just fit in so well to the system here and just thrived in it. So it'll be so interesting to see what she takes back to Egypt and how she develops her life there. So,
and you're still in touch with her now that she's back.
Absolutely, yeah.
In Egypt,
we would never lose track of each other. She's my daughter, my exchange daughter, and I'm her exchange mom, M-U-M.
Yeah.
Because there still is that British influence over there that Kay spoke of, having been in Tanzania and Eastern Africa.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, thanks for sharing that with us, that kind of personal perspective on that organization. And so other people can become host parents, host families.
Yes, anyone can become a host parent. You can be a single parent and be a host parent. You can have children in the home. You can have an empty nest. All different types of people have involved themselves in the program and almost universally have experienced joy. And then, of course, the sweet sorrow of parting.
Right. Yes.
So.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Kat.
So we're moving on to another topic related to education, our third in this segment. Something not quite as light and cheerful as the previous one. We're going to be talking about the oppressive and hostile environment that faculty of color often face in classrooms and from students, particularly at predominantly white universities, how that disrespect is manifested, and what can be done about it. In researching this topic, and I found there is quite a bit written on it, actually, I came across an article titled Teaching While Black, and I'm just referring to the title here. So it's a reference to the idea of being a target of harassment and questioning, as is captured in the phrase driving while black. So it's pretty telling that, there's for example, an article that uses that phrase as its title, Teaching While Black. So let's dive into this important topic. I'm joined in the studio by Dr. Julio Camarota, an associate professor in the School of Education here at ISU. Good morning.
Good morning. Hello, Gail. Nice to be here.
Good to have you here. And we're also joined on phone by Dr. Lerona Lewis, who is calling from Montreal, Canada. Are you there, Lerona?
Yes, I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thank you. It's great to hear your voice. To disclose that Julio is a colleague of mine in the School of Education, and Dr. Lewis, I knew her when she was a graduate student, and now she has her doctorate. So it's great to hear from you again. So let's start with Julio. Julio, you've been at ISU for 1 year, mm-hmm. and before that you were at the University of Arizona.
Yes.
And at both universities, you frequently teach courses that address social justice and diversity and those kinds of issues.
Yes.
And you recently had a rather unsettling experience with a particular reaction to what you were teaching. Can you tell us what happened?
Yes. This was a few weeks ago, maybe a month ago, one of my colleagues asked me to come to his office in order to hear a phone message. So it turns out that the phone message was left at 2 o'clock in the morning. And my colleague said, you know, he really thinks this is racial because I'm one of the few Latino faculty in the School of Education. And the phone message was directed towards me, and it was a message left for the director of the School of Education. And this particular person was trying to warn the director about me. He more or less was saying that I had ruined the life of his brother-in-law, that I had transformed him or brainwashed him to becoming a Marxist, and he no longer his degree that he received in engineering is no longer of any value anymore because he works at a low-paying job. And then he said, you know, this person who was calling said that he was angry at me. He said his entire family was angry at me. He called me names. This person was talking about his brother-in-law who took a course of mine, a social justice course in Arizona, and the brother-in-law took up these ideas of social justice, and his relative did not like this, did not like his change of attitude, his change of his perspective, and so the caller then ended by invoking Trump, and this is where my colleague thought that it was racial. He invoked Trump, saying that
we can play that segment.
Sure,
okay. Is that okay?
Yeah, let's play it.
So let's play that.
He got brainwashed by this guy. This guy is a communist, and he is sitting there undermining the educational system in the country. When Donald Trump's president, the House on Un-American Activities is going to come back, and it's going to come back bigger than ever.
So, yeah, that's very, very disturbing. So what were your thoughts when you heard that message, Julio?
Well, I was taken aback. I was quite shocked. I thought my immediate thoughts were, wow, this is a part of the Trump effect in the sense that he was emboldened to track me down and say these kinds of things. So it was a very scary moment for me when I first heard this because I felt like you know the phone call was at 2 o'clock in the morning. The message was left at 2 o'clock in the morning. So this person was very sort of, you know, and, you know, aggravated at me, and you know, this was I felt it. It was an attack, a personal attack towards me. So it was very unsettling.
And again, based on the nature of the course that you teach, mm-hmm. Which is a social justice course, and presumably based on your identification as a Latino professor. Mm-hmm. A faculty of color.
Yes.
So we're going to talk in a minute about, you know, the implications of occurrences like these and what the university's responsibility might be. But let's bring Lerona and some of her experiences into the conversation. So you're still there, Lerona?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. So you were a graduate student in Canada when you became interested in the kinds of hostile reactions that faculty of color were receiving from students on course evaluations. Can you tell us briefly what happened that got you interested in that aspect of this topic?
Yeah, sure. So I began to teach the course Multicultural Education in 2012. And in 2013, I decided to review my course evaluations. And I did not expect what I was going to see. So I saw comments like the only thing she brought to the course was that she was black, she doesn't like white people, I didn't learn anything from this course, and several other very hurtful comments. So to me it was shocking to actually read that about myself, and I just kept it to myself for about a month and a half, and then I decided to just browse to see if there was something in the literature that could help me understand, because at that time there was no black professor in the Faculty of Education that I knew at McGill. So I found a series of articles that described this experience, and I was struck by the way that it was so similar over a 30-year period. Mm-hmm. So to me it meant that there's something really present that's systematic, and it's really about racial microaggressions that people of color face on their student evaluations. And this was particularly difficult because as a student who wasn't funded, I relied on teaching to be able to support myself. And so I wasn't hired again to teach, and I began to try to figure out why I wasn't hired again. And I met with someone in the administration, and I was told, well, if you were a faculty, if you were going up for tenure, you would definitely have to get your evaluation numbers up, with total disregard for the racial comment and derogatory comments that were on my course evaluation. So again, I was struck by the ways in which we could ignore things that are really discriminatory and just focus on numbers, and the ways that those numbers are used to position people of color within the university.
Right. Could you explain for the listener what you mean by microaggression and why you see those comments as racial microaggressions?
Okay, so the definition of microaggression that was provided by Sue and others, they're just commonplace derogatory statements that are made possibly not intentionally by the person, but still cause or still considered to be hurtful. So someone saying, like, to a black person or a person of color, oh, he or she has a chip on her shoulder. That's a very loaded comment.
Mm-hmm.
Someone saying, for example, that a black man is racist ignores the actual systemic history that's associated with the word racist or racism. So those are the ways in which people of color could be positioned as incompetent. And it is tied to their skin color, for example. And those things are very hurtful because they happen so insidiously. Someone doesn't actually know that they're saying it, but it still can invalidate the experience that a person of color can bring to a learning environment.
And then you followed up on this and did and carried out some research of your own into this idea of these kinds of comments on course evaluations. Can you tell us just a little more about that?
Well, what I've found is that it's disturbing, especially in an educational environment, because oftentimes students tend to disregard the experience or the knowledge that a person of color, a faculty of color, can bring to the classroom. So by associating our ability to teach with the color of our skin, what we bring is not valued. And, for example, if there's a science teacher, who shared his course evaluations with me, and that teacher was trying to show the link between science education and racist ideologies, and the students wrote on the course evaluation, "Stick to science. We don't want to hear about race." And that's very disturbing because we know that particularly in science classrooms, children who are marginalized or from different racial backgrounds that are not white tend to suffer in science classrooms, and they're not represented in the classroom in the pedagogy. So when students ignore the value of what the faculty of color is bringing to the classroom, they can continue to reproduce hurtful pedagogy in the classroom because they didn't take the knowledge that this professor was trying to help them to understand. So it has very real implications for the elementary classrooms later on.
Yeah, so both you and Julio are preparing teachers for preparing future teachers. So you're pointing out that what happens then and how they take the information or resist taking the information,
yes, right,
resist really learning from you, has ramifications for how they're then going to carry things out in their classrooms.
Yes.
So more so than someone learning science, it really has forthcoming ramifications. So Julio, as you hear about Lorona's experiences, what are your thoughts and your reactions?
Well, you know, I was at the University of Arizona. I was an ethnic studies professor, so I had more diversity in my classroom. So my evaluations were okay, right? Occasionally a student would say that, you know, maybe I wasn't effective. One or two students might have said that, but it's interesting that when I came here to Iowa and was teaching the multicultural education course, I decided to look at the evaluations, and I was shocked. I was shocked. Students just saying stuff like, "I'm narrow-minded. I don't value their perspective. I." Silence students. And, you know, and it's funny because pedagogically, you know, my style is always about, you know, I express my point of view, but I always say that every point of view is allowed in the classroom. We can talk about it. I may disagree with you, but it's allowed. But it's interesting just to see how students, if for some reason you don't fit the standard traditional if you don't look like the standard traditional professor, or if you don't sound like the standard traditional professor, students will automatically start resisting what you're saying to them. They'll start thinking that you're somehow trying to, like the caller who called up said that I was, I'm trying to brainwash students. I'm just offering a perspective, a social justice perspective that might be different from a lot of the courses that they take. So this is a shock for many students.
Because you're pushing them out of their comfort zones. I often say teaching multicultural education is like teaching a regular course, but it's also like group therapy, because mm-hmm. you're really pushing them to consider other perspectives and other ways of thinking and think critically in the real sense of thinking critically. And it's uncomfortable for them, and they often resist and then retaliate both in class, right, and in their course evaluations.
So multicultural education, this class that you're teaching, is a required class for all teachers to go through?
Yes, yes. It's pretty reasonable, rational course for students to take because the changing demographics, changing diversity of the student population. So it's really important for teachers or pre-service teachers to understand what are the needs of students of color, understand the experiences of students of color as they become teachers. So this is, it's a no-brainer from my perspective. You know, this kind of course is valuable for teachers as they enter the teaching profession.
Right. And so you're saying that when you were in Arizona, you were teaching students who voluntarily chose to take ethnic studies.
Yes.
Whereas now you're teaching students who are forced to learn something that, you know, learn about issues that they don't think are relevant to them. Or,
and a course like that is required pretty much in every state in the country for future teachers, and also in Canada. So Lerona was teaching a similar course at the university there. Let's talk a little bit about them. What's the university's responsibility in, or what can they do as far as these kinds of course evaluations or other forms of resistance? Lerona, I know you tried to get some changes instituted at the university there. What kind of reaction did you get when you raised this issue and tried to get people thinking about what could be done?
Okay. So initially there was the sympathy, and people thought that it probably was an important issue, but I think that there was a tendency to think that every teacher has horrible first evaluation, so don't take it personally. And
right.
I felt, as the other scholars have said, it was a kind of micro-invalidation, an invalidation of my experience and it being a racialized occurrence. So I complained at different levels in the university. But eventually last year, I found someone in the university responsible for racial and ethnic relationships, and I went to that person, who is kind of outside of academia, and that lady was able to push it through. So now there is a faculty of color can have comments that they believe to be discriminatory or derogatory removed from their evaluation so that it does not affect their total score. The problem is that many faculty of color still don't know about that the possibility.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as I know, it probably did happen, but as far as I know, it was not widely circulated. The other way I look at it is that the university has a responsibility to prevent employees from experiencing demeaning or comments in the workplace. It's part of the Canadian human rights. So at this point, I don't think the universities have the choice anymore to decide that this is not an important issue. It is an important issue. Every employee is supposed to be guaranteed a workplace that is free of harassment. SETs are sites where harassment takes place. And universities really need to take it seriously today, because it is literally, it can be really crippling for someone to have that experience.
Yes, it can be crippling professionally, as you mentioned, but also the psychological impact.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Yeah, and then of having that invalidated when you try to bring it to people's attention. I know that there have been attempts in different places to put particular wording onto course evaluations to give students examples of what's productive, critical, but productively critical comments, and what are inappropriate comments. Has anything like that been done?
There are examples now on the website where there is go to the site for student evaluation.
Mm-hmm.
So there are examples of things that are helpful to the professor and things that are not helpful. In my case, because I value comments that students make, I no longer read my evaluations. I bring them to the teaching and learning services, and ask someone there to read them, so that they can then filter the comments and then give me the comments that are useful and helpful. Because some students will have legitimate concerns or legitimate comments that will be able to help me to improve. But I do not want to have to face the onslaught of harassment. So I found that has worked for me, and it also makes university institution now become aware of this problem. Because before I had brought my actual evaluations in, it was just like a hearsay. But But when other people can actually read it, one of the comments was, this is literally bullying. It's online bullying. So having other people actually read the comments, I think that helps to kind of push the system mm-hmm. and to institute change.
But that's so telling that you felt the need to do that, and but that you also respect your students' productive comments enough to
yes.
take that step.
Yes.
Julio, what are your thoughts?
You know, I think everything that's being said is very important. I think that the university needs to take some proactive stance in terms of the evaluations and you know, recognize when a student is saying something hurtful or demeaning or derogatory, they should be more active in screening these evaluations. I was shocked, you know, when my particular director pointed out negative evaluations. But I think that has to be put into context. You have to sort of think about the faculty, if it's a faculty of color, and then put it into context.
Right.
Gail, I'm curious. You teach the same course. You're a white person, but you're teaching social justice issues. Mm-hmm. So do you find comments on your evaluations that show a resistance to the subject matter that's divorced from
yes.
issues of racism?
Absolutely. In class and on the course evaluations, yes. And I mean, I think a lot of these issues are also intersect our social identities. So there's gendered things that are happening with, for example, white males in my classes and from my course evaluations that are different than maybe things on Lerona's and Julio's, but still very much resistant and derogatory and hurtful in different ways.
It's so interesting. It's just such a clear playing field sort of power relationships mm-hmm. and how the students who have felt their power as white males, for instance, challenged and now are kind of lashing back and trying to take that power back.
Yeah, power has a lot to do with it. Yeah. We could go on and talk about many, many different aspects of this, but we're about out of time. So I just want to thank both of you for being here and for your honesty in talking so candidly about what you face, particularly with the course evaluations. So thank you both.
Thank you
for having me. Thank you
very much.
It's an important topic. Dr. Julio Camarota from ISU School of Education and Dr. Lerona Lewis calling in from Montreal, Canada.
Okay, and that's it for Local Talk. We're going to go out with some West African music. And we had some East African music earlier. Now we're going to listen to Sona Jabarta and do our outro over that. You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. We've been your hosts, Greta Anderson and Gail Seiler. We started out the show with Kathy Hansen, Director of School Community and Media Relations at Ames Community School District, and Melissa Askloff, an AmeriCorps VISTA member. We then turn to Kay Puddock's Community Service Appreciation segment on Dell Christensen, Executive Director of IRIS, Iowa Resources for International Students. Speaking of their high school exchange program and what students have gained. And Gail, we ended up with Julio and
Lerona
down in the schoolyard.
Oh, she's making a joke. Yes, so thank you both for being here. Local Talk is broadcast on KHOI at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. You can also listen to today's Local Talk show and all of our past shows online at our website, khoifm.org. There will be contact information for the people and places we talked about today. Local Talk was engineered by Evan Taylor. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Cape Shelley.
Yes, and I don't have the name of the East African artists, but this we're listening now to Sona Jabarta. There's a number of YouTube entries for her. She must be very popular. She's from Gambia. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.
Funding for KHOI is made possible in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. In the heart of Ames, the Ames Main Street Farmers Market brings local food and fun. Located between the 300 and 400 blocks of Main Street, including Tom Evans Plaza, the Farmers Market provides fresh local fruits, veggies, meats, breads, handcrafted goods, live music, and family entertainment every Saturday.